Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, everyone. This is Chad. Today, I am having the pleasure of talking with Nis Frohm, the producer of a new podcast for product managers and developers called This Is Product Management. He's also the director of demand generation at Alpha UX, a product validation platform. In addition, he's an award-winning software developer and web designer, and he frequently goes by the title of Storyteller. Nis, thanks so much for joining me and the other everyday innovators that are listening.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Glad you're here. Now, of that long list of great credentials and experiences that you've had so far, I'm most curious about that title that you like, the Storyteller title. What does that really mean to you?
Sure, it's a great question. And before I go into that, I really just want to take one step back and clear a misconception I've often heard. When I say Storyteller, it's not really my own story, per se, that I'm telling in that role, but it's really figuring out the story of the user's perspective. And where I realized how important that kind of hat is to wear is, during my last company, sales was definitely not something we were familiar with. And we found that we thought intuitively you sell the value proposition, right? You know, that's logical. But what I realized is that the buying process is very illogical, and that customers often don't buy things purely based off a value proposition. That may be one piece of the decision-making process, but there are many other aspects, such as, you know, are competitors using this product? Has it been socially vetted and validated? And often, is anyone even bothering me to fix this problem that I have? Do I need a solution? Will the solution be risky? Will I risk my job taking it? Can I get a promotion without it? Mm-hmm. So when I say storytelling, it's really discovering that story that resonates with the user and helping them tell that story along with your product, not as much. What is the story of how we built the company? I found that most people don't often care about that.
Yeah, they really care about what's going on in their world and not theirs, right? Yeah, so it's the storytelling of making sense of the product and how it provides value in solving the customer problem.
Yeah.
So from that customer's perspective. Very good.
Absolutely, yeah.
So clearly you have found it important in product management roles to have this skill of storytelling.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, you know, people don't buy based off of pure value proposition. If in 2008, Drew Houston, the founder of Dropbox, had gone to people and said, you know, I have a file storage system on the internet, first thing people would think is like, you know, internet's always down, there's problems, I won't be able to get my files, et cetera, et cetera. But when he says it differently and says, you know, I left my USB drive back in my dorm room, and now here I am at this presentation, I don't have my file with me. People say, oh, that's happened to me. Do you have a solution for that? And that's just the way people think. People think of, you know, I'm in point A, I want to get to point B, right? They don't necessarily think about all the they don't think necessarily logically. It's very much an emotional reaction. So that's why storytelling is so important. People connect with stories. It provides them context in terms of evaluating products, in terms of using products. And that's why storytelling is so important, those reasons.
Right, relating it back to the problem they're actually trying to solve and having it make meaning for them.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, we got connected because you guys have a new podcast and you're the producer of it. And I'm really excited to see another podcast that's developing with product management topics. As far as I can tell, your podcast and the Everyday Innovator are the only two that's currently creating new episodes, you know, for those product managers, developers, and innovators. Yours is titled This Is Product Management. How did that podcast come about and who's involved with it?
That's a great question. You already answered half the question, which is that there's not a lot out there for product managers. So unfortunately, there's not a lot of great content. So some of the content out there is fantastic, but there is not enough for product management and the trend and the role and how critical the role of product management has become to so many organizations. I mean, so essentially what you said, we interviewed product managers at the end of 2014. We interviewed about 110 product managers and we asked them, what are your challenges? And what we found was that all their challenges were different. And what I mean by that is they were different from each other and they were different even within one person from a day to day. You know, it depends what department are they speaking with? What type of product are they launching? What do they need to know for that product? They wear so many different hats and the the challenge is that they don't know how to wear all these hats. And we said, you know, what if we come out with a podcast that doesn't so much focus on all the speakers, although the speakers are important, but focuses on specific topics that you need to know, that you need to know on a daily basis, but also ones that you just need to know in select circumstances. And the feedback was positive, so we went ahead and we launched 3 episodes. And so far, the feedback has still been very positive. Subscriptions have increased, and we're seeing really good response to the new podcast. This is Product Management.
Very good, and I like the format. I enjoy how the host does the interviews with the guests, and kind of has that little NPR flavor to the production quality. So, but you're the producer, and I hear a different voice on the actual podcast. Who helps you with this?
Yeah, so that's Mike Fishbein, who works with me on creating content for Alpha UX. So he has done podcasts before. He's really an expert on customer development. It's amazing seeing him in action when he's actually, you know, working on a product and speaking to customers. And we agreed that it would make a lot of sense if he did the interviews. And he's really great with them. He gets to the crux of the topic that we're talking about, whatever it is, really kind of gets at what this speaker would want to tell product managers. If they have 20 to 30 minutes to speak to all product managers out there, what would they want them to know about this speaker's field? Whether that field's in product, and oftentimes it's not, we'll speak to, you know, someone whose expertise is in community management, community service. Often those people are on the front lines of user feedback. You know, what do they want to tell the product people? Are they often overlooked? Product people take months to figure out an insight that a customer service rep could have told them in 10 minutes. Right. So those are the people we speak with. What do they want to convey to product managers?
Yeah, absolutely. And good point highlighting the customer service folks, that so often we're trying to solve what we think will be the problem that provides value to the customer. And we completely overlook what the biggest problem already is that our customer service folks know about.
Yeah.
Excellent. So who is the ideal audience for the podcast? And, you know, what kind of things can they expect to be learning from it?
Sure. So the podcast is called This is Product Management. So it's definitely it's a specific audience. I don't think you have to be a product manager to gain value from it. Of course, the great thing about podcasts is that or at least our podcast, not necessarily every podcast, is that you don't have to listen to episode 2 to listen to episode 3. Right. So you can pick the topics that are interesting to your specific field. So I think the target is definitely digital product managers at enterprises. We'll often talk about how these topics relate to enterprise. Startups have, we often say startups have it good. They don't have as many stakeholders. They don't have as much internal politics going on that they have to consider. And one of the main topics we focus on is, you know, how does this relate to, you know, figuring out all the different stakeholders and the diplomacy that you need to have when you approach this topic. Mm-hmm. So definitely startup people can get something out of it, but I think it's anyone who works on a product at a large company can really have something to gain from this podcast.
Yeah, I think that's a really important distinction that kind of has that enterprise flavor. There's a, you know, frankly, there's a numerous podcasts out there already for the startup person.
Yep.
And we've been lacking with having information for product managers that are working in established organizations,
yep,
but still doing a lot of those things that the product manager in a startup does in a different context.
Well, on to that point, actually, one of the things we found was that, in fact, enterprise product people were listening to some of the startup podcasts and were taking those practices and applying them to enterprise, which, of course, is great. But there are many, many, many nuances that were being missed out. You know, the whole minimum viable product from a lot of perspectives has been misapplied to the enterprise in that they're going ahead and these massive companies are launching products which then fail, but they don't realize when a startup launches a product, you know, it's 2 months of development and the entire team is engineers. They have nothing else to do. So they launch a product and they get feedback. But a massive company has numerous other ways to get feedback than launching a product that are more cost effective and less risky. And so it's those sort of topics we talk about. How do these change when it comes to the enterprise?
Yeah, absolutely. So often we hear this phrase in established companies, the enterprise, that, you know, we just need to innovate like a startup.
Yeah.
But how do we actually put meat behind that? What does that actually mean?
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
it's different in the startup environment, as you point out. You have less stakeholders involved, and the stakeholders is really where the thorny issues in organizations come into play.
Yep. So those are a lot of the topics we talk about, how to navigate that.
So since you brought up MVP, talk real quick about the I know I read from you and your company talking about minimal viable experiments. And what's your take on that and why the MVP doesn't quite work for the enterprise?
Sure. Yeah. So the minimum viable experiment is a great, I guess, phrase that my colleague Stephen Cohn coined. I'm not sure if he necessarily came up with the concept per se. I think Eric Ries really, or even before him, had this concept, but called it a minimum viable product. And the idea for Eric Ries was not to get a product out there as quickly as possible, but to get something out there that you could get feedback on as quickly as possible. And as I said earlier, for a startup, it makes sense that you build a product. You're all engineers. It's the most cost-effective thing you can do is build a product. And if it fails, you don't have any risk. There's no brand exposure. You know, your entire brand was that product, and it fails, and you relaunch another product, and that's it, right? But the point is not launching a product. The point is getting to a learning stage, is to get as many touch points with the customer as possible. And this has been completely misapplied at many large organizations, where they're going ahead and launching products when they could easily, just as easily, launch an experiment, which, first of all, allows them to get around a lot of stakeholders saying, you know, the legal department says the product has to have X, Y, and Z. Engineering says it has to go through this quality assurance. Marketing says it needs to fit this, you know, ROI prospectus or whatever it is, right? And when you call it an experiment, you get around that because you say, well, I'm not launching a product. I'm running an experiment, right? So, but not just a semantic difference. It's really a practical difference, is that there are things that are far more cost effective for a large organization to do. They can build out a simulated prototype. They can run a survey. They can bring customers in, prospective users, and ask them questions. For a startup, sure, they can do this too, but it won't save them that much time or money. And it won't save them any risk, like I said, from just launching a product. But at a large organization, it makes so much more sense to run an experiment. You can learn through four experiments what you would have learned from launching one product, and you won't risk anything.
Right. I think the change in terminology really is important. And we hear in enterprises, you know, we need to adopt this lean approach of doing the MVP and, yeah, you know, quickly learn from that. But as soon as we attach product to what we're doing, it kind of takes on a different life of its own. And by that change, which I have not come across until I started listening to your podcast, that change in thinking about it as a minimal viable experiment, I think, is really helpful.
Yeah, like I said, it's like you just said as well. It's not just a semantic change; it's a practical change.
So back on your podcast, at the time that we're talking, you've had 5 episodes out. I know when our Everyday Innovators listeners are hearing this, there'll probably be a few more there. But so far, you've had topics on demand validation, community building, user engagement, hiring and also career advancement. Of the topics, so I'm not asking about the guests, I'm sure all the guests are equally fabulous, but of the topics, which of those topics most resonates with you?
So that's a great question. I appreciate the caveat there. Yeah, so all of them were great episodes, all great speakers. I think the topic that definitely, you know, resonates was the first episode we did, demand validation. And it's a little bit meta here, because the entire podcast was demand validated with the first episode. So we somewhat did that accidentally. But, you know, in hindsight, from my storytelling role, I'll just say we did it on purpose. And so, yeah, demand validation is this really interesting space right now that, like I said, is you know, in our space, you have to agree that data is better than opinions. You know, that's really the first, you know, thesis you have to believe in to believe anything else I say on this podcast or in any of our episodes or anything we do, right? You have to believe data is better than opinions for making product decisions. But between that and continuous experimentation is a really big gap that a lot of companies try to just, you know, hop over. They don't really think about it. They're like, okay, we agree data is better. Let's just start running thousands of experiments for the sake of running experiments. And there's really something in between, which is demand validation. It's before you can optimize a product, before you can, you know, decide what features, what user segments, what pricing, is this single type of experiment that validates that anyone actually wants this value proposition. The simplest, most core aspect of the product that you are pushing forward, does anyone want that? And then once we can validate that there is demand for this value proposition, then we can do all the other different types of tests, like usability tests and continuous experimentation on the product. But there's a specific type of experiment. There's a few different experiments you can do to validate demand, but that really gets you from 0 to 1 before you can go from 1 to 1,000.
Very good. So demand validation sounds like it's really part of your wheelhouse too. And it's related to the topic I'm frequently asked about by product managers and product developers, which is basically, you know, how do we conduct those experiments, or how do we learn about our customer's problem and craft a solution that they really want, right? Something that provides value. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's that question of how do we know we're creating the right product, mm-hmm. right? Because in the product management world, our headaches aren't with creating products, it's creating the right product.
Correct. Yeah.
So what experiments are actually helpful then? If we're going from experiments to demand validation to actual product, what experiments do you use to help with demand validation?
Sure. That's a great question. There's a bunch we use, and I'll just talk about some of the ones one in particular that we don't use first, just so listeners can get a sense of what I'm talking about. When I say you're going from zero to one, and you want to create a product, you don't start talking about all the features and prioritizing features. You wouldn't run a usability test to decide if people can use a product if you haven't even determined that people want the product. So when I talk about demand validation, I'm talking pre-usability, pre-market research. We're not thinking about scale. We're not thinking about how big this market is. We're thinking like, does a single person want this product? Because if we can't find a single person that wants this product, then there's no point in continuing, right? And on the flip side, this is also not a replacement for understanding your users. That's another thing I don't see as often, but I've seen companies think that, well, if we just run experiments, then we don't really need to talk to users. We don't need to understand them on a daily basis. We can just run one-off experiments. And it's not a replacement for that either. This demand validation assumes you understand your market, you understand the customer, but before you start optimizing the product, you just want to validate that there is demand for it in the first place. So the type of experiments, I'll mention two in particular, one very much old school, one very much modern. The old school one that I love is in-person interviews. There's nothing like it, primarily because you can follow up with the person in real time, you can see facial reactions, you can see, their how they follow up, how they think. It's a really immersive experience with your user, and it's never bad to speak to a target user. It's always great to do. So in-person interviews are really important for demand validation. You can ask them, what do you do to solve this problem? Is this a problem? Or why don't you talk us through how you go from X to Y and see if there even is a problem? Oftentimes, they'll go on the internet and they'll go to a site and they'll show you a service they use you didn't even know existed. And like, voila, they already have a solution for it. So, what problems are there with that solution? And as long as you don't lead the user during the in-person interview, it's a common problem. It's leading them, this is a problem for you, isn't it? And, no one wants to, you paid them to sit down with you. They're not going to tell you what you don't want to hear if they know what you want to hear. So make it very ambiguous what you're looking for, and just try to make it as authentic a conversation as possible, and just keep asking follow-up questions. You can learn a lot from an in-person interview. Oftentimes, even though it's a little bit more expensive and doesn't seem like it can scale, scale is not important for this aspect. You just want to learn as much as possible. And it's great to do an in-person interview. So that's the first type of experiment.
And before you go on to the second one, let me ask you a little bit about that.
Sure.
And for Everyday Innovator listeners, back in episode 10, we had the pleasure of talking with Ash Murai, the author of Running Lean. And we talked about this notion of, running experiments and what that means in terms of interviewing customers too. And it was interesting. He shared as a previous developer his cautiousness, his unwillingness to want to go talk to real customers, but the value in doing so, right?
Yep.
And I'm curious, so you really emphasize the importance of talking with actual people, doing those interviews, not leading them, getting their insights. But how do you go about finding people that are representative of, the problem you're trying to solve with this product idea?
Well, that's actually a great question. And that's something that often comes up to us. It's like, it's so difficult to find users. It's like, wouldn't you want to tackle that challenge now rather than after you launch a product? Because at some point you're going to have to get in front of, the people you want to buy your product. So if you can't do it now, when can you do it? So it's not
a really good point.
Yeah, it's not supposed to be easy. If it was easy, we'd all, you know, be multimillionaire launching products every day, right? So it's not easy. It's supposed to be difficult. But again, you don't need 1,000 users. Often you'll rarely find a product that solves one person's problem and only one person's problem. Maybe that exists. I have not heard of it per se, but that's pretty rare. So, you know, if you can find 2 to 3 people that want a product, odds are there's a few more of them out there, and you can figure out how many more of them out there step by step. You don't need them all on day one. You just need 1 to 3 people to say, yes, this is a problem I have. Yes, your hypothesized value proposition sounds interesting. What's next? Like, can I see a wireframe? Okay, that's still interesting. Can I see, you know, something else? And it's iterative. It informs your next round of experiments. So yeah, sourcing users, it's not like where are all the customers? Let me put this in front of all of them. Okay, great, bought it. It's not supposed to be simple. So we source them from numerous different ways. We can run ads to source them. We can use third-party vendors to source them. They may be existing customers. So it's numerous different tactics, but none of them are straightforward or, you know, silver bullets.
Right, absolutely. And I don't know if you've have any experience yet with like how many users. I know as I've talked with other practitioners, it's not a big number, right? Typically, we're finding saturation, meaning we're not really learning about new aspects of the problem, like between 8 and 12 people or so. You know, yep. It's not a large group of interviews to do.
No, not at all. It's not a large group, especially if, I mean, it really depends if you're onto something or not. If you're not onto anything, well, you know, 100 different users are going to tell you something you don't want to hear, and you can spend your whole life interviewing people and still never learn anything that you want to learn other than, you know, it's been invalidated. So I guess from that perspective, you're learning.
Right.
But if you're onto a product, that's one of the questions we get asked. It's like, well, how do you know when you're onto a product? It's like, that's usually the easy part. You know, finding that you've invalidated a product, that's, you know, work hard to invalidate something. But finding that people want it, you know, that's they'll tell you they want it. So
absolutely,
that's much easier.
And it could be that if you've done 100 interviews and they've all said not interested in that, then maybe you actually do have the product idea that only is for one person, and that might be yourself. Who knows?
Right. Exactly.
Okay. So doing those interviews, one of the tools that you recommend for experiments for demand validation. What was the other one you want to tell us about?
So the other one is one that we were fortunate enough to have in today's day and age that product practitioners didn't have even probably 5 years ago, at least not to the ease of use and ubiquitousness, but is interactive prototypes. I mean, there are just so many great tools out there where in, I would say, under 2 hours, you can build out a pretty robust interactive prototype, put it in front of a user, and oftentimes have them think it's real. And no coding, again, like I said, no legal, no other stakeholders have to give you, you know, their input and what we call armchair quarterbacking. No one has to get involved. You know, you can, product people can do this themselves. They don't even need a designer. Can build out interactive prototypes using tools like Envision app and you know, UX Pin and stuff like that. They can build out pretty decent prototypes and go and run users through experiments, and they can track what they do throughout the prototype, what they click on, what value propositions. One of the things we often test is an onboarding experience, a first-time user experience, which is you know, the experience a user would have the first time they use a product. It would kind of be the tutorial. And we learn a lot from that, because we learn like what aspects of the app are they interested in learning more about, like which features do they click on, which features do they X out of the tutorial, and which features do they continue on with the tutorial? So we can do all of that. We can run an experiment like that in a couple hours and get a ton of data from what they do in the app. And then we can ask them surveys at the end of the app to see, you know, on a variety of metrics, would you pay for this? Would you recommend it to a friend, et cetera, et cetera? What we call a perception of value. So we get a lot about their behavior and a lot about their intentions. And that's definitely one of my favorite experiments.
So when we use these interactive prototypes, they can get used for a few different ways. The issue that I've ran into that I'm curious about asking about is,
sure,
when we make them look too real, like it's a prototype that looks like a done product, sometimes customers that we're interviewing are resistant. They don't actually make this known to us, so we can get bad data, but they're kind of resistant to criticizing the application because it looks like so much work has already gone into it and it's real, right? So I know sometimes prototyping activities have worked real well, where it's even a whiteboard talk where you're just kind of drawing what this thing might look like, right? What the user interface might look like for the product. Mm-hmm. Have you ran into that or any comments on this issue of prototypes looking too real and that distracting what your end result is for the experiment?
That's definitely, it's actually funny. We're running an experiment on that right now, which is, how real the data is in the prototype. Does that impact the user's perception of the prototype? You know, if you're testing a healthcare app and they say like, whoa, this is not how much I weigh. This is not my blood pressure. And it's like, relax, it's a prototype. Does that impact their decision? So that I will get back to you with the results of that experiment. What I can say, however, is we never will test a single variant of a prototype. So it's always comparative. We're always testing multiple variants. So even if they're all there's some problem with all of them, it's comparative. We want to know, A to B to C, what are the differences? And we're looking for outliers. You know, we're not looking for a 1% difference. We're looking like these two really didn't perform well, and this one performed substantially better. So even if they all rank lower than we wanted, we can get a sizable amount of learning as long as we do split tests and multivariate tests. So that's one of the solutions we have that can overcome a lot of these challenges when doing prototyping or any other type of experiment is to split up the cohorts of users and test them through different prototypes.
Okay. So in that example, when you're doing the split testing, you actually are creating a different cohort of users. You're not showing the same prototype to the same person to get their feedback.
Right.
You're going to different people and getting.
We'll usually do, 100 users to each prototype. And we'll ask them a set of questions at the end. And we're not looking for 50%, 50%, 53%. We're looking for like 12%, 12%, and 88%. That's some meaningful learning there.
Okay. So, the tool you're talking about, this sounds like a software environment.
Yes. Right? Yes. It's part of, the platform we rely on that we've built and the capabilities we've built, as well as, a number of third party tools out there that are great, from Sketch to Envision to, Stephen Cohen's company Validately. So a lot of really great tools out there to use.
Well, that's a good lead into your actual day job, right? Which is the director of demand generation at Alpha UX. So it sounds like that's a tool from Alpha UX. Let us know what Alpha UX does.
Yeah, so we provide product managers at enterprises with the capability to generate real-time user insights. So instead of, like I said before, opinions, making decisions, and waiting on research teams and other, in-house capabilities, what we enable product managers to do is to rely on certified designers to build out prototypes rapidly, to source custom user panels in over 50 countries, to run simulated experiments, and get feedback within 24 to 48 hours on different product concepts and variants. So rapid and real-time user feedback to make product decisions. That's what we do.
Right. So if someone is developing a software product and they're asking these questions like, well, is this user interface better than this version? And does it make a difference if we move the button or we change the flow of the questions we're asking? So you have a platform that adds into their delivery environment, like if this is a web-based
doing? Exactly. Integrates entirely with their product team. So, we have an onboarding process and, they get an account manager and it fully integrates with the way their team does product development. They transition to a very experimental environment where every single, opinion is turned into a hypothesis and run and there's feedback on it. They get feedback on it 2 days later. So they're running tons of experiments per month, per year, and it's very much, much more continuous running experiments on any sort of product concept. It doesn't really matter to us. It's not a per project. We don't onboard a product. We just onboard a team and then they can run whatever they want and they can switch off week to week what sort of hypotheses they want to run.
Okay. So that's the business model. It's basically for an organization. It's a tool for them to use for their products.
Yep.
And with the move to software as a service and cloud services, I would think there's a lot of demand for this kind of demand generation tool, right?
That's what we found, yeah. So I think we've really hit a good note in the industry. We have a lot of enterprise product managers who read the Lean Startup and read all these lean practitioner books and they want to do it and they want something that fits for the enterprise that isn't going to cut them down from 3 months per experiment to 2 months per experiment, but that cuts them down to 2 days per experiment so they can do their jobs, which is, interpreting this data, deciding what to do next, and not spending hours upon hours putting together prototypes and finding user groups and et cetera, et cetera.
Right. And automatically compiling the data and helping you make sense of it.
Exactly.
That's a big deal.
That's what we found, yes.
Very good. So how long has AlphaUX been around?
Yeah, we've been around now for about a year. Mm-hmm. Started a year ago. I joined about 7 months ago. Haven't looked back since. It's been a lot of fun. And it's been a really good learning experience where we try as much as we can to eat our own dog food and to learn as rapidly as we can. So we turn everything we can into an experiment, whether or not it's related to product. You know, the whole podcast, This Is Product Management, was an experiment, right? You know, we invested, you know, X amount into it. And if it didn't, you know, if the response wasn't positive, well, that was it. It was going to be a 3-episode podcast. So we really try to apply this thinking to everything. And even before the podcast, we were running surveys that people wanted the podcast. So even before we spent anything, we asked people.
Your process was much more formal than mine. I had actually spent a year traveling the United States in an RV with my family, and I was interviewing people involved in product innovation along the way. And I missed once we got back home, I kind of missed the experience. So I said, How can I continue those interviews? So,
well, you're your own user then.
So I am.
That's just as important. Being a user of your own product is one of the best UX practices you can possibly have, I think.
Yep. Very good. Thank you. And let me ask you about an innovation or success quote that you love and why you chose it. Which one do you have to share with us?
Sure. So we have a quote on our wall, which is, "We are kept from our goals, not by obstacles, but by a clear path to a lesser goal." It's a quote I really like. You know, creating achievable but very difficult goals. I think, you know, anyone who's seen the movie from last year, Whiplash, knows that, you know, good job are two very dangerous words in the English language. And that's really what we try to live by, is if you set a goal of 2, you will reach 2. But if you set a goal of 10, you will reach 5. And it's because by setting kind of outlandish goals, it forces you to figure out things you otherwise push off. It's like, you know, you can hit X. So, you know, that's what you set your goal to be. And you hit X, of course, but you don't think you can hit Y. And if you were to hit Y, you would have to figure out so many other variables there. And so setting these kind of stretch goals really forces you to figure out and optimize beyond what you really thought you could do. So that's a goal I live by, and I think it's really important to product managers to use these stretch goals for the way they set and achieve new tasks.
Great. Thanks for sharing. Thank you. Thanks for sharing the quote. And I love that you guys have that written up on your wall there at the office. It kind of reminds me of that short phrase, you know, good is the enemy of great.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got to push yourself and set those goals that really do stretch you.
Yeah.
So once again, I want listeners to know about the new podcast and how I found out about the work that you're doing. The podcast is called This Is Product Management. How can listeners follow you and your work and make sure that they are getting notices on that podcast?
Yeah, so listeners can go to thisisproductmanagement.com. Made it pretty simple. They can subscribe via email or iTunes or Stitcher or SoundCloud. So really got the gamut of options there. And they can also learn more about me on Twitter at @NissFrohm or at @AlphaUX. That's @Alpha_UX on Twitter. Thanks, Chad.
Very good. Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training Your Customers Will Love You For. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.